Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Did you know something? Fun fact. I'm going to throw in a fun fact right now.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that the original voice of Tony the Tiger is also the same performer who sang "You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch."
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I believe his name is Thurl Ravenscroft.
What?
Yes.
Thurl Ravenscroft.
Yes.
So he's a gnome from Skyrim is what he is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Are you kidding? Seriously?
I'm pretty sure. I was watching The Grinch with the wife on Christmas Eve and just happened to look that up. And I thought, oh, wow, this guy is the original Tony the Tiger. That is impressive. Let me just look this up right now.
I thought it was a more famous recording artist who did it. It's just this guy who did these two things. I mean, I guess he was too busy like imbuing artifacts and, you know...
capturing dragon souls,
right, making great axes, you know, in the Skyforge.
Of course. No, Thurl Arthur wild. Ravenscroft.
Holy shit, how do you get a name like that, man?
I don't know. I feel like you've got to pay for a name like that.
Seriously.
Was an American actor, voice actor, and bass singer known as the booming voice behind Kellogg's Frosted Flakes animated spokesman Tony the Tiger. He was also the uncredited vocalist for the song "You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch."
Oh, he was uncredited. That's why.
Yep.
Yeah. That's wild, dude.
That is bonkers.
Oh, man. All right.
That is insane.
Yeah. You want to get into this episode?
Let's do it. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Goat Season. Thank you so much for being with us. We're excited to have you. This is a podcast about the greatest individual seasons of television of all time, their most memorable episodes, and their creative teams, both in front of and behind the camera. I'm your co-host, Phil Mitchell, and along with me is the man with many nicknames.
With many nicknames.
Many nicknames.
Hey, I'm only half Irish. Come on, man. You can't be throwing that around.
Known in the Deep South as only the Devil's Burden.
Only in the deepest of the South.
Only in the deepest South.
Yes, Alex Sinesi. That is my actual name. Glad to have you too, bro. Hell yeah.
Today we're talking about episode 4 of The Sopranos. Yeah, Meadowlands. Getting into this should be good. I'm excited.
Oh yeah, man. Like we were talking about, this episode really ties together the mini arc that's been going on for the past 3 episodes. As I was saying, like kind of structurally, it feels like a miniature season finale. It feels like the same sort of extended resolution across all of the previously, you know, created story threads.
Yeah.
And I think it's no coincidence that it was directed by the same guy who directs the season finale, John Patterson.
John Patterson?
Yeah. Who handled a bunch of their season finales. He actually passed away kind of young, I think before the show ended. But
really?
Yeah, like his last directing credit, I think, was the season 5 finale. But he was really well-liked by the cast and crew. And I mean, I think he does an awesome job. I think you look at it and this episode covers so much ground. It has so many different subplots and it just sort of fluidly moves between them. And
It handles them pretty deftly.
Yeah.
And quite masterfully, I think.
I think so too. Very deft indeed. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For sure.
And lots of little like set pieces, you know, nothing too major, but you know, lots of little confrontations, and every single one of them is sort of well covered and fluid, but they run together really well. It's not like, it doesn't feel like a choppy episodic sort of story, you know?
No.
Anyway, so the episode starts with the first dream sequence in the entire series.
It's the first one that we see, right?
Yeah. Because he talks about the one with the ducks and the pilot, of course. But this is the first one that's actually visualized and stylized kind of in the manner that later ones will be.
And it's one of my favorites.
It's solid, man. I mean, you know, it's not as elaborate and disturbing as they get later on, certainly.
No.
But you got all the hallmarks there, the really wide angles and sort of intense sound design in the background, you know. But my favorite part is just, this is maybe the best shot of Paulie Walnuts ever, when he puts that newspaper down and he's just got the wings going and he's lit from above. He looks like Sam the Eagle from the Muppets, dude.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that look so he's intense. Giving the camera is great. Yes. It's perfect.
Yes.
That whole sequence, I love it. Just from start to finish. It starts and it's so uncomfortable with Melfi with like the short skirt and like the legs, and it's like, this is weird. I don't really like this. And then it transitioned into what is it? He walks out of her office. He sees AJ briefly.
Yeah.
Looking in at him. And then he sees Silvio Dante, who's getting it on with some girl.
Just mugging like crazy, man.
Yeah. Where does it go from there? It's
then you see Paulie and Big Pussy with the cigar. Freud reference, I'm sure. And then he walks back in, and before the reveal, when it's just, you know, the back of Melfi's head, that's when you get Jackie, you know, Prio. Sitting up. Yeah. And he mentions like thunderstorms and rain. I thought that was interesting because the very next episode, college has like a big thunderstorm in the middle of
that's
it.
Right.
And weather in general is like a touchstone through this season where they bring up like shifting weather patterns, you know, sort of prefiguring what's going on, you know, some pathetic fallacy type shit, some, you know, literary reference type deals.
Of course. Why not?
Yeah. Your look of disgust is totally warranted right there.
You know, we skipped over the fact that Hesh.
Oh yeah,
shows up at the very beginning, and he's like outside the window, and he's walking, and it just doesn't look right.
He's walking.
It looks like he's floating.
Yeah. He's on a treadmill or some, you know, moving sidewalk type apparatus. Yeah, that's a nice moment.
And I think Dr. Melfi refers to him as Heshy, which is interesting in that moment because it's almost like a pet nickname that she's giving him.
Yeah,
and I feel like it's implying that she knows him intimately, which Tony clearly is like terrified of, right?
Right. She has familiarity with all of his friends, and that terror revisits him through the episode that he's going to be discovered.
Yeah. So I think after that, I mean, just I guess a recap of the entire episode. There's the dream sequence, and then that shifts to Christopher getting out of the hospital. In the previous episode, he had Uncle Junior had him tuned up by a couple of thugs. Underwent the mock execution there. And so Christopher's just getting out of the hospital with Adriana's help.
It's really a funny scene.
Fantastic scene. Fantastic scene. She kills it. I love just everything that Drea De Matteo is bringing to that scene.
Yeah, we haven't talked about her much, man.
We haven't.
Yeah.
You think we definitely should.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, episode 10, I guess, is kind of her spotlight episode. Mm-hmm. So maybe we'll go more into her backstory there. But it's so cool to see how in the pilot, she was this unnamed restaurant hostess,
mm-hmm.
clearly cast for just a one scene part. And Chase liked her. He brought her back in. You know, she gets this role, and just episode by episode, she's getting more dialogue, more material, more right. chances to shine. I think this is the first scene where she really gets a like big showcase, and yeah. she and Imperioli are just so good in it, so funny together. He's really making that like neck brace work through this whole episode too. He just the way that his head is just like shrunken into it, he looks so pathetic.
So sad and does. So vulnerable too, right? He like it's does. Just this guy trying to be so tough, but he is just
yeah he's like
sorts.
This little like shriveled up dick in the whole yeah. episode, you know.
So he gets out of the hospital,
yeah,
angrily confronts Meadow because he believes that Meadow has ratted him out for mm-hmm. selling her the drugs. Turns yeah. out he's completely wrong. He goes to get his friend Brendan Filoni, and that's when he finds out that Brendan has been on the receiving end of the Mo Green special and that Brendan's dead.
Message job through the eye, he says. Yeah. It's like everything's so fucking dramatic with him. It's like, yeah. oh yeah, this is a message meant directly for me, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, come on, dude.
Come on, man. Get over yourself.
And I love when Paulie's like, yeah, yeah. It was just how Francis framed the shot for shock yes. value, you know?
I only caught that on when I watched it recently. I hadn't ever really like registered that line so up good. Until recently. And I realized, oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
Such a good moment.
Because they've chewed over Godfather so much at this yeah. point, you know? I mean, the fact that, you know, Big Pussy refers to it as in one, you know? Yep. He doesn't have to mm-hmm. say what movie. Just
not at
in
all.
One.
It's just a yeah. shorthand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. That's where they're at with this.
So at that point, what Christopher, he kind of goes off the rails. He's really upset. He's yeah. ready for war, ready to take it to a mattress.
Oh. take it yeah. to the mattresses. The mattress. Not take it to a mattress.
No, he's going to take it to just one mattress, man. Just one.
It's a real intimate war.
It really is. You know? Just one mattress.
It might
mattress.
Turn sexual at any moment.
Who knows,
take
man.
Take it to a mattress.
So he's ready to take it. And then I think from there, it transitions to what Tony and dealing with the paranoia and then also balancing that with how he's going to deal with Uncle June. Yeah. And so the paranoia is so bad on Tony's end mm-hmm. that he decides he's going to hire not a private detective. He's just going to hire a detective to tail
Melfi. He's had yeah. Vin in his back pocket for a while now. It's
that's a
it's
good
clear.
Point.
Yeah, I
right.
mean, Vin's gambling debts have essentially made him on the Sopranos payroll mm-hmm. for some time already.
He's such a reprehensible character. Like, I feel like he's one of the grossest characters on the Sopranos.
He's introduced like pissing in public.
Yeah,
he's just nasty. Outside of an elderly folks' home.
He's just so okay. nasty.
I don't know, but it's funny you say that. I actually have a lot of sympathy for his character, especially Oof. On the rewatch. He's so pathetic. He's so obviously this alcoholic, broken down dude, but he so badly wants to make like a personal connection with Tony. He wants Tony to be his friend so badly. The way that he instantly like launches into his backstory about yeah. two alimonies and all that shit, it's like he wants to open up so bad, and Tony just does not give
not
a fuck about this
that.
Degenerate gambler, you know? But I don't know. I mean, part of it too is probably like just growing up watching Home Alone, you know? John Hurt.
Oh, that's
is
right.
Mm-hmm. Just, you know, he's such a like warm, funny presence in that. But I mean, he's only in, I think, 3 or 4 episodes this season. But to me, this is like his definitive performance. This is yeah. what I always think of with him. He's so incredible in this season. And it's this Oof. Really brutal, tragic fall for
terrible.
This
yeah,
pathetic
just
guy.
Nasty human being. He is.
You
he
have
is.
No time for him.
I don't. I am siding with Tony on this one. I'm just like, yeah, get this guy out of here.
He is horrible in this episode. I mean, when he beats up Melfi's.
Yeah, and that, like, yeah, let's just like, go ahead and just skip right to that, because the yeah. next thing that he does is that he tails Melfi. He doesn't even just like watch her from afar, which he no. could do. No, mm-hmm. he's got to go harass the woman while she's out on a date
yep.
and then beat up her date.
Yeah.
2020 style. with he's just terrible. It's just, yeah, it's all types of nasty and bad.
I love when he steps on the guy to step over him, and there's this like jaunty little like skip that he does when mm-hmm. he steps over his body. Mm-hmm. He's just so enjoying like enacting this violence with no consequences. Yeah, you're right. He is a piece of shit. Like, honestly,
thank you.
He's horrible. Thank you.
Even Tony recognizes this.
But that being said, like, it's so telling of this show that even that character, you get such like sort of pathos from him, though. You understand, true, that he is such a like broken, pathetic guy who wants to have a more personal connection with Tony. And then, you know, true, he just falls back on his gambling habit. And I mean, he just keeps fucking himself over.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think around now is the scene with Tony and Livia at Green mm-hmm. Grove with the macaroons. Right. Yeah, right. It's a small scene. I think it's just there to sort of set up how Tony is dealing with elderly family members for the mm-hmm. eventual like junior strategy. But what I really like about it is when he opens up the box of macaroons, Nancy Marchand is so good in this. She has this tiny little look of delight. She smiles for 1 second, and you can tell it's her favorite thing in the world, and she's so happy. And then immediately she like switches and she's like, oh, they're so sweet. And she's, yeah, you know, she's just like, no, I don't want them. Oh, leave some out for the lunatics, I think she says later. So, you know, God, this way she'll get to eat some.
Yeah.
She's not going to admit she wants them. Yeah.
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 That was tough to watch.
But yeah, it's a great little moment of acting there when she first sees them and how she just like has to shut that down. She has to, you know, put her emotions back on lockdown.
Right.
And Tony is like, I come here to cheer myself up. You think that's a mistake?
Mm-hmm.
So funny. Mm-hmm.
So I think from there, it really just kind of focuses on how Tony is going to deal with his conflict with Uncle June.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think from there it moves to a scene where Tony talks to some of the DeMeo crime family capos, I believe.
Mm-hmm. The lobster scene?
The lobster scene, which is great because we haven't met any of those guys or seen any of them before. Mm-hmm. So it's just a good like introduction to, again, the world Larry of the Sopranos.
Boy, I love the imagery there, how it's like every single one of them has this giant Maine lobster that they're mm-hmm. feasting on, you know, mm-hmm. just underlining the opulence at every level of this organization. That seems interesting to me, though, man. I'm curious about your opinion on this. In it, Jimmy has a moment where he's like, your uncle, you think he's paranoid enough to go to war? And mm-hmm. everyone has this like awkward moment. And I think the original intention was everyone's supposed to be just a little spooked by him saying war, you know,
right.
Nobody wants to like confront that. But he's so bad in this scene, the actor who plays Jimmy, he's so terrible. And I wonder if David Chase didn't get the idea, if he didn't have the idea already, that Jimmy would be the rat at the end of the season by this line. Because this line, I feel like you could also interpret it in retrospect as he's wired up and he's asking, is there going to be a war? And everyone's like, don't mention that so, you know, plainly.
That is a good question.
Yeah. I'm curious which one it is. I have no idea.
I remember listening to an interview with Chase and he talked about how at the end of season one, mm-hmm. when Big Pussy goes missing, everyone thought that was intentional. And Chase was just like, no, that was sloppy writing. We didn't even quite know where he was at.
Right. And he didn't know that it needed to be like resolved as this big deal that would be everywhere. You know, he didn't realize he'd set up this huge cliffhanger, essentially.
Right.
Yeah.
So my guess is that you might be onto something. I think it's possible that you could almost read it retroactively in that way. So Chase is just kind of like, oh, yeah, that did not work out. So why not have this guy be the rat?
Be the rat. Mm-hmm. I think that's what happened. It's so funny because it works perfectly having seen it already as, oh, this is the first sign that this guy's not on the level.
And exactly.
I think it was just a bad performance in the moment, you know? So that kind of brings up something I wanted to talk about with this episode in general. With that scene, that's a small example. And then we were talking earlier about the increased role of Adriana and how she was doing so well that they just kept giving her more material, you know, bigger scenes, and she's just killing it the whole way through. It's an interesting example in television production of how at this time, especially, you could make little adjustments when things were really working in a series. It's something that doesn't really happen anymore on streaming shows now, because you don't shoot a pilot and then come back. You just shoot the entire season. As soon as you have a green light, you are basically on rails through it, and you have to like plan out who's going to be a major character right from the
start.
You
have to know that going in.
Yeah, you can't give people these little gifts where they keep, you know, increasing the size of their role till they become a series regular. And I guess that works more with sort of the tightness and the structure of streaming shows, but you also don't get these moments where creators are really able to capitalize on what they have episode to episode. I mean, Drea De Mateo is amazing on this show. She's
wonderful.
A little kind of underserved by the way that we're covering this, because I feel like season one, she's still very much emerging. And then by season two, she's a series regular, and she just has much bigger scenes, much bigger arcs through the whole rest of the show. Where season one, you know, she hasn't really gained that spotlight yet, but she is awesome. And I don't know, I love to see that. I feel like that's something when you're watching television week to week, you can really root for these performers and enjoy them. And you see how the same thing happens with the show's creators, and they're like, yeah, we have to keep giving this person more chances, you know? I don't know, maybe my favorite example of this, just because it was something where like I called it super early on, it's not a great show at all, but did you ever watch Arrow on the CW?
No,
I mean, it's not a great show or anything. I don't know, it's just something that was like easy to binge, I guess. There's this character in it, Felicity Smoke, who the actress who played her was so clearly hired for a 1 minute single scene in a random episode where she is a secretary at a desk who is just like directing a major character as to like where to go in an office building. And she was so good in that scene. She popped so hard in that scene that I was like, we're seeing more of her. They're going to bring her back. And then in another episode, she's in the same role. And then a couple episodes later, now she's a named character and she's starting to be like involved in the plot. And I shit you not, dude, by the end of season two, she was the co-lead of that series from this one scene. And I felt so gratified where I was like, she was doing so awesome in that one scene. I know they're going to keep using her. And she literally became like the second series regular on the show.
You felt vindicated, didn't you?
I did, but it was crazy. And it's like, that's the kind of shit. I mean, obviously that's like, you know, kind of simple action superhero show, and the production was probably sloppy, and that's probably evidence of it on some level. But it's cool to see in television when these characters come up. I feel like that happens on sitcoms all the time too, where you have your regulars and then you have people who just like pop with like one line an episode maybe, and next thing you know the show's about them, you know?
That's what happened with Family Matters, right? Like that's Steve Urkel all the way. Like he came in, it was just supposed to be a bit role, just this nerd that was in love with Laura, I think that was the character's name, and then like Jaleel White just came in and just like took that over. And then the show basically became about him.
I was going to say, that's almost like the dark version of it, where his character infected everything and it had to be the Urkel show.
Yes. You know? I feel like isn't there a Key and Peele sketch about that in some ways? I think there was.
A side character just consumes everything.
I think it might have actually been about Family Matters. I'd have to go back and see. Yeah. I might be remembering it incorrectly, but there definitely was a Key and Peele sketch about Jaleel White and Reginald Bell.
They're such
Bell
nerds.
Johnson.
You know, when they bring this up, they're thinking about it in terms of production. Like, God,
so good.
everyone was just like held hostage by this character. The writers are like, oh no, we need like 50 Urkel jokes an episode now.
Right.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Sorry. So anyway, to get back to it, where are we
go
at
for
the
it.
Episode? No. I was interrupting your recap flow.
No. I think from there, like the episode goes to Tony confronting Junior. That's right. He takes the staple gun to Mikey Palmese.
Oh yeah.
Right. Outside the restaurant. And then goes and sees Uncle June. Uncle June comes up with a pretty cold line. I love the line. If you're going to come back, come heavy or not at all.
Oh yeah.
Which I think is great. And so I forget where it goes from there.
It's just funny you mentioning that, because I mean, the stapler gun is a great, like, low rent sort of a mob weapon. It just makes everything feel sort of tawdry and like pedestrian, you know, that he's attacking a guy with a staple gun. But at the same time, like, I was just thinking, so the entire time Tony's talking to Uncle Junior, Mikey Palmese is out on the street with staples in his chest, just screaming in pain. Like, I mean, barely across the street. I feel like they would have heard him, you know?
Yeah. Such a great scene. I like that. He goes back, I think, and then sees Melfi a short time later, like a couple of days or something like that. Melfi gives him unintentional advice on how to handle your elders. Tony like takes children. It to heart. Like children. Let them think that they are in charge because that's what they like. Tony takes that to heart. And then I think that's his. I mean, that's the reason why he goes and he supports Uncle June's candidacy for new boss.
So
right?
Well for him.
Does. And he gets exactly what he wants, but I think it just like it makes him look, it puts some shine on his star. It gives him a little bit more pull within the organization, because I think I forget what he receives in return, but I think he gets some
Bloomfield
pull
in the paving union.
Exactly. Yes.
They don't go into what that is exactly, but you understand that it's like, oh, he's actually getting a monetary gain. He's getting more control. He's essentially taking on more responsibility and also getting more actual authority within the organization. And Junior's getting the title and the respect, which is what he craves, you know. Junior doesn't really care about earning anymore. He just wants to be the boss. And it's like, in reality, he's allowing Tony to continue to be the boss, you know, with that. So Tony really, like, he makes out like a bandit in this situation, but Junior is so happy. He's so placated by this.
So it's got that scene, and then I think like the other subplot is AJ and his conflict with his classmate and, you know, the fights that he's getting into. I think just the ending is really what I think makes that of some consequence, which is he realizes that his dad is a mobster after I don't know how many years of being ignorant of the fact that his dad is a gangster. He finally, he doesn't even figure it out. Like Meadow tells him like, duh. Dumbass.
Oh, she's like, so good with the like withering looks. Like, you really don't get this still.
Rolling her eyes so hard.
Yeah. I love that 90s ass website that she pulls up with the mobsters on it. And it's just like crappy gifs as far as the eye can see.
Mm-hmm.
Just
with some
guns
really poor sound.
Blood.
Yeah.
And she says, I'll print this out. It's like, oh, yeah. Make sure you print out all these GIFs. Absolutely. That's great.
That way you can look at them later, AJ. Right? Yeah, that's so 90s, man. Not to mention AJ's rocking the Marilyn Manson shirt. Did you notice that?
Oh, yeah. He's a perfect 90s that. Kid.
He
He's
really
a perfect
is.
Rap rock shithead.
That character.
Oh, God. Man. I mean, it's so funny, though, dude. I'm the exact same age as him. And so there are certain freaky things about it. Like, I was listening to some of this terrible music at
listening
that point
to the
in
butt
high
rock,
school.
Huh?
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, also, I was playing Mario 64, like, heavy, dude, at that exact time, man. And that scene where, you know, Tony sits down with him and plays for a second, totally, right. Like, mishandling the N64 controller, by the way.
Right.
He's mm-hmm. only using the stick. That would not
hand.
Work
yeah.
at all. But that being said, like, I mean, that scene, it's just such a rush of nostalgia. You know, I could totally have seen, like, me being obsessed with Mario Kart 64 and my dad coming and, you know, playing for like 10 minutes in some vain attempt to connect with me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It hit me in the feels, man.
That was a good scene. I like it.
Yeah, Gandolfini's so great in all those moments where he's just trying to be a dad, but it's never overdone. It never mm-hmm. feels like TV heartwarming moment. It's, mm-hmm. it's so good. It just feels really real.
I think the episode pretty much ends with Junior being coronated as the boss.
Yeah.
Jackie Aprile has passed away and they're all at Jackie Aprile's funeral.
Oh, well, we have the great scene at the Bada Bing where they learn.
That's right.
Death.
Yeah.
And,
oh my gosh.
Such
that scene is poignant and then hilarious right at the very end.
So hilarious. Chris just running in full head of steam with his scenarios.
Yes.
And I love how every member of the crew tries to save him. Every member of the crew is like, dude, just slow your roll, man. Mm-hmm. It's okay. Like, this is not the time. All of them, Silvio, Big Pussy, with just like a hand gesture, like, take it down, dude. And he is not listening. He's oblivious. He's just in his own world. I love that he re-edits the end of Scarface so that it involves bazookas.
Right. Bazookas under both arms, I think is what he says. Like, it's like, come on, man.
That's so telling of his character that he's like, I want to do Scarface, but I want to do it bigger. I want to be firing missiles at these guys nonstop.
No need for that, man. Gosh.
It just makes no sense, dude. Like, what are you, Turok the Dinosaur Hunter? How are you firing these many explosives in an indoor space?
Oh, man. Ugh, what a scene.
Tony grabbing him by the neck and just instantly having so much intimidation, physical presence. Yeah, he just absolutely runs Christopher over in that moment. Mm-hmm. And Chris is like, you're the boss, and, you know, just shrinks back up into his sad turtle state in that neck brace. He looks so funny through the whole episode with it, man. He's doing such a great job with his physicality in it.
Yeah. I think also what Tony also makes he recommits to therapy, because I think at the beginning of the episode, he was so paranoid that he wasn't going to continue with it. At the end of the episode, he tells Melfi that he's going to continue and that he finds it useful. And I think that's interesting because I'm going to go ahead and go here. But during the last pod, we had talked about how Melfi ends up firing Tony because she reads a study about how people with sociopathic tendencies only use talk therapy as a means for their own personal gain, which is exactly what he is doing in this episode.
Yeah.
And so I remember, like, you know, we were talking and we said, you know, hey, why was it such an abrupt end? Why did it take her this long? And it's there from the very beginning, right?
This is a classic example. He's just using it for
personal gain.
Yep. Yeah, I get some good ideas here. I think it's interesting, too, how Carmela has this big scene with him where she's like, if you stop going to therapy, I have to reevaluate our marriage. And he's like,
right.
he's just like bowled over. He's like, in the middle of everything else I got going on, are you fucking kidding me? You gotta start in with this. And that threat doesn't really have any impact on him continuing therapy or not. He has to wait until it's actually advantageous for him. And Carmella can do this. And it's just like, the way he absorbs it is, oh, you're just piling more shit on my plate right now. But it doesn't factor into his decision to actually continue with therapy, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just a tiny little thing I noticed, dude, but the salesperson at the landscaping store where he's picking up his pesticide, you know,
who
where
was
he's
that
like,
guy? That person looks so familiar.
It's Guillermo Diaz, who's been in a ton of shit. He was Huck on Scandal. If you ever watched that show, he's like the best character on that show, but he works all the time, dude. Mm-hmm. And looking at this, this was before he was in Half Baked. I think they were probably shot right around the same time, but I'm willing to bet this was like one of his first roles ever. And he just popped up for like one line there.
As soon as I saw him, I was like, this guy has a TV face. I've seen him before. Mm-hmm. I know this guy from somewhere, but I just could not remember from where. Man. Yeah. So
he was on
like
Weeds a bunch too.
That's right. Yeah. I think I'd seen him on that too. Huh. So what'd you clock in this episode?
I mean, a lot of little stuff, you know, I love Junior's outfit at the funeral. Cause he's wearing this pinstripe like black suit with a sharp ass fedora, and he just looks like Al Capone in the fucking 20s. He looks like three generations past iteration of gangster. So it's just so funny to see. Oh yeah, that's where his head's at. You know, he's the boss now, and it's all. I mean, aside from having a fucking Tommy gun, he's just completely looking that part, you know, being in a James Cagney movie or something. So I thought that was great. And Tony makes a reference to World War II, which I thought was interesting. Like, these people got us through World War II, which I think it's Chase kind of being a little condescending there, where he's essentially saying, especially the way Tony looks at it, these characters live such a black and white existence where they were like, we were on the good side of things, we were fighting evil, and now it's like things are more complicated, you know, everything's much more uncertain, you don't really know who your enemies are anymore, so it's like, let's just make it simple for them, you know, he's the boss. Let them ride out their twilight years thinking that things are still cut and dry,
man.
Yeah,
I also thought it was interesting when Tony talks to Melfi about the first time that he saw a dead body and just like the circumstances around that.
It's so tossed off. It's like at the top of a scene and it gets interrupted because we go into her whole traumatic experience. But yeah,
right.
I thought that was really telling too.
I thought that was interesting, if only because then it ties back to AJ and it's just like a loss of innocence, right? It's about him having this experience where he comes across a dead body and then AJ basically figuring like he can no longer be innocent or ignorant of the fact that his dad does horrible stuff for a living.
Yeah, but it also shows the huge gap in experience between them, because Tony's saying
that
he was maybe a year or two older than AJ when he saw a guy who got clipped and he knew why it had happened. And it's like, compared to AJ, who, you know,
is playing Mario Kart,
right? He's playing fucking Mario Kart and worried about like his polo shirt getting ripped. Those are his concerns. So he's just not ever gonna reach this level, you know. We already know he's not going to actually be brought into the fold, which I'm sure is Tony's intention. But at some point too, I think you also feel like Tony probably wishes that his son seemed like a more solid guy, and he's putting all of these he's putting a lot of pressure on him unduly and unintentionally to be more of his sort of masculine ideal. And I mean, the kid just doesn't have his life experience at all. It's totally different.
Not at all.
Yeah,
not at all. And I would say probably for the better.
Oh, I mean,
AJ is doing the things that kids should be doing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. He's not looking at dead bodies
of course,
in ditches
right?
in the meadowlands. Yeah.
He's doing exactly what a 13-year-old should be doing. Getting into fights at school.
Right.
Tearing up your clothes.
Calling people fart knockers.
Exactly.
It's the most games. 90s insults.
It really is.
Yeah.
That's the best he could come up with. I can't believe that on a TV show where they're dropping the F-bomb all the time. That right. is the best thing that AJ Soprano could come up with.
Yeah.
You got to do better.
Exactly. You're listening to like Marilyn Manson and Korn right now. I'm sure they're right. providing you with quality. More extreme language you could be using.
Exactly. You know? Do better, AJ Soprano.
Yeah.
Do better.
I love the song that plays over the end credits, Look On Down From the Bridge by Mazzy Star. I really like that track. It stood out to me too as maybe the first end credits song that the main characters wouldn't listen to. You know, before this, it's been mostly more like classic rock, blues rock, very much on the vibe of like stuff you could imagine playing in the back room at the Bada Bing. Whereas this song is much more just about emotion and atmosphere. And, you know, I imagine too, it's prefiguring Vin's death in the season.
That's a good point. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, the bridge is this symbol of crossing the threshold to death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man.
But yeah, really solid episode. Pauly is awesome as always. I love the way that he's deployed here, especially because just like the moment outside of the hospital room where Tony says, first off, Paulie's like, oh, I know where Mikey lives. I can go like kill him right now. And Tony's like, no, if Chris tries to leave, break his other neck. And like Pauly just immediately shifts into, okay, now I'm watching you. And you get that sense that he's this blunt instrument, but he is so loyal. He is so ready to do anything. He's like, he's the ultimate, you know, right-hand man. And
he really is. Yeah. Without a doubt. Like, he's the guy that you want at your back in a bar fight, right?
Absolutely.
Guy knows what's going down.
Yeah. Yeah. He has a moment in the Bada Bing too, after, you know, Chris is chastised for his Scarface fantasies, where he's like, you'll do what you're told when you're told. And that line reading, oh, man. Talk about frosted flakes, dude. That shit is cold. And it's
so scary.
It's so scary. You just feel like he has told people that. He has been told that. Like, I mean, that is real life experience just coming through so strong. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He's awesome.
So you had said that John Patterson directed this episode. Mm-hmm. Was it Jason Cahill who wrote this episode?
Yeah. And this is interesting, dude.
Yeah.
He got a WGA writing award for this episode.
Wow. Which,
you know, a big deal. Very
That's
cool.
a big deal.
Here's the thing, though, man. He was not on the writing staff by the end of the season. A bunch of people weren't.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the only people who David Chase retained for season two were the team of Robin Green and Mitchell Burgess, who wrote. They write a ton of episodes across this, this whole show. And Frank Renzulli, who stays on through two, but essentially otherwise, he just like wiped out the entire writing staff from the season. Like, I think they were all like contract players and they weren't actually hired, and he just didn't bring them on again.
Yeah.
And I imagine, I mean, people talk about what a strong hand he took writing every script. And so, you know, it's weird the way that TV writing credits work, but it's oftentimes like you have your executive producer, your creator, who is the head writer, but then people get an individual credit on an episode. Like Jason Cahill gets the credit on this one, I think, and David Chase. I think he shares a credit, but still, like, he gets the award for this episode, and yet, what was his actual contribution? Like, what did Chase do to his draft after the fact? It's impossible to know, but you certainly get the vibe that there was a lot of auteur energy flowing Chase into the writer.
For sure.
And they kept it very small. Like,
very, very small.
Yeah, going forward. Green and Burgess had worked with Chase on Northern Exposure, so that was him already bringing on people he knew. And that does happen a fair amount in the writer's room, where, you know, things will get shifted around, especially after a first season. But just to not like retain anyone with the exception of a few people you've worked with, that says a lot. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was there anything else?
I don't think so. Oh, wait, you know what? I realized last recording, we did not give Melfi a grade. So we should do it this time around.
Definitely.
So that was my mistake. I apologize. I think this time,
apology.
Oh yeah, my
accepted.
I think this time, Melfi, she does a decent job.
Mm.
She goes a little bit too far into her own personal stuff.
Sure.
With Tony. And so I got to dock her a few points on that one. So she gets like a B minus. I think the first time I saw it, I thought, really shook my head, wagging the finger at that one. Come on. This is not the time. This guy is coming in, paying you some cold, hard cash that he probably stole from someone.
Exactly.
You got to respect that. Respect the time. Respect the hour.
Yeah. So what was your favorite scene?
I would probably say the dream sequence is my favorite scene.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like all of the emotions that it pulls. It pulled a lot out of me watching it, just from being like a little bit creeped out to laughing.
It really unsettles you.
It just unsettles you and just puts you in like kind of a weird space. So I felt kind of like creeped out, and then I was laughing, you know, when I was looking at Polly and Syl. And then, you know, and then you just feel kind of weird seeing Jackie Aprile, who looks dead.
Yeah.
In that episode.
Yeah.
And then like the close up on Livia is just like very unsettling. So yeah.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's probably my favorite. How about you?
My favorite is definitely when Tony walks back into the diner and he's like, "All right, Junior, I came heavy this time, but I don't want to use it." And he kind of leads him on for a moment, you know, with the Sopranos has been waiting a long time to take the reins. And then he's like, "And I want it to be you."
Mm-hmm.
And we go into this great close up right behind Junior where Tony is hugging him and he's grabbing the back of his head.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, just whispers like, "And you know, I can't be perceived to lose face in this whole arrangement. So just, you know, give me this one thing." And Junior is so happy to at this point. He's over the moon about his new position. So, but I love the physicality there. The camera keeps pushing in really tight as like Gandolfini's just grabbing the back of Junior's head.
It looks like he could just squish his head like a grapefruit.
Yeah.
It's kind of scary in that moment.
It is. There's that closeness of this huge dude who just, he seems like an imminent threat at all times. And yet he's being so warm here too. He's so physically effusive. And people have said too that usually when that happened, it wasn't scripted. Like,
interesting.
James Gandolfini would just like grab people's faces and like get really close to them and talk to them in this super intense, like very Italian way, you know? and it's so compelling, you know? And, I think that whole scene, the reversal there, Chianese's work is so good as always. It just the little like flickers and eye movements as, you know, he's learning that he's going to be the boss.
Yeah.
He's trying not to like just freak out. He's trying not to he's trying to keep it together, you know. It's great to see
that whole scene works so well. Love it.
Yeah, this really wraps up that 4-episode arc, and the next episode will be standalone and an incredibly strong episode. I mean, everybody loves College, but it is fascinating how they finished off this mini arc, and that immediately gave them the freedom to go into a really strong, not bottle episode, but something very contained and cinematic right after.
Yeah.
And you just see the show continuing to hit its stride.
Is it time for Name That Episode?
Let's do it, man.
All right, man.
You got three queued up?
I've got two. We're going to do two this time.
You're always...
I'm always aiming for two. I feel like ever since I screwed up, I've got to be careful.
You got to be cautious.
I've got to be cautious.
But here's my thing, man. If I get one right and one wrong, we gotta break the tie, you know? I mean, you can't leave me like unsatisfied where I'm like, 50% correct. You
might have to deal with it.
A failing grade. I might have to deal.
You might have to deal.
You might have to go fuck yourself.
All right. You ready?
Yeah.
Let's do this. Okay. This season 4 episode of The Sopranos finds Tony and Carmela almost purchasing a new home, but ends with Tony being kicked out of the house. It snagged an outstanding writing Emmy win for Green, Burgess, and Chase.
Oh, it's Whitecaps, right?
There you go.
Dude,
it's a good episode.
Their whole fight, their whole argument, and how it almost gets physical is just one of the great acting moments of the whole show. And I would say of the entire like era of television, honestly. Yeah.
Did you see that reunion that they did, like the 20-year reunion where like it's got all of them, like Chianese's there, Imperioli, Sirico, Edie Falco's there. And I'm pretty sure one of them mentions the moment in Whitecaps where Tony just loses it and it's about to get physical. And I remember Edie Falco saying, I don't even remember shooting that.
Yeah.
And I was shocked that like that was such a powerful moment. And like, it just kind of like, it just kind of went through her. I don't know. Like,
I don't know, man. I don't know if it's that she, you know, just like, forgot it and didn't like take it home with her, or if she was so, if they were both so in the zone that they're like, I don't even know what we're doing.
It's funny because I almost got the feeling that she said, I just didn't take it home with me.
Could be that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That seems like people say that that was definitely her general MO, was like, she could come in, do a really heavy scene and just reset, and it wasn't her. You know, she could perform and then just like switch it right off. And she was, you know, just relaxed and casual again after, which is the opposite of Gandolfini.
I look forward to being able to talk about Falco's performance.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, next episode is a huge one for her, and
yeah,
get into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Number two. Mm-hmm. All right. In this episode of Battlestar Galactica, the Cylons return.
BSG. Return. You don't even have to say that it's the remake. You don't even have
Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I love it. I love where we're at.
This episode of Battlestar Galactica,
this is the Ronald D. Moore Battlestar Galactica.
Yes, just in case you didn't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In case you don't know out there, listeners.
Yeah. This episode, the Cylons return, and return again.
It's 33.
Number of seconds. There you go. 33.
Okay. Incredible episode of television.
By far.
One of the best. We were talking about like second episodes a little while ago. And the weird thing about this is it's a second episode after a four-hour miniseries that functioned as the pilot, which is very strange.
It's really weird. I went and looked at the Wikipedia page and it called it both the first episode and then also said it was it's almost like the second episode though. It's weird.
Right, because like the miniseries is almost like
that's season the pilot.
0.5 in a way, the way they treat it, because they talk about 33 as the first episode of the first season. It's odd. But yeah, amazing episode of television.
Yeah.
Here's my thing. I know you like The Last Jedi better than I do.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna go on a little bit of a rant about it. I have this feeling. The reason that there's this incredibly stupid low-speed chase all through that movie is because Rian Johnson was so into the idea of 33, where the Cylons keep like FTL jumping in at the last second and everybody has to like scramble to get away. And he was like, oh yeah, I want to do that across my whole movie and have like the Empire keep, or the First Order keep hyperspace jumping in and attacking and they have to like get away. But he's like, oh no, I can't rip it off so, you know, just bald-facedly. So he changed it to, oh no, they're like slowly pursuing the rebel fleet and just shooting ships as they get in range, and it's so much less effective.
Yeah.
But I swear that was a 33 ripoff, dude. And that's why it's messed up.
You
have the grumpiest face right now. It's so good.
It's not even because I'm disagreeing. Like, I could see that actually being the case.
Yeah, that's totally the case.
And it's bothering me. It's bothering me so much right now. I don't like that idea. And yet it seems like something that could have happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Ugh, man, that's just making me all just icky inside.
It's just part of the reason I have such a problem with the second act of that movie. Anyway, I don't need to be airing my grievances about The Last Jedi. What am I doing?
Oh, no. Just air them all. Just go ahead. Take them all out. Just dump them all out.
The internet doesn't have enough of that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just add a little bit more salt into that one.
Yeah. You want to do one more? Any series. Dealer's
Any
choice.
Series.
Come on.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Give me 1 second here.
Okay. Well, you have the list I gave you, right?
I do.
Of the ones that I could possibly do. I mean, going outside of that.
I mean, you have to admit, saying I could name any title from one of these seven shows.
Yeah.
It's a bold claim, but then also I think you're a little bit too big for your britches there.
Oh, that's shit.
Right. That's right.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. We're getting so real right now.
It's like, oh, yeah, you know what? Just these seven shows.
Oh, get the fuck out of here, man. That's like over 1,000 episodes of content, bro.
My God. I knew you would object to that.
You were fucking with me right now, mm-hmm. aren't you? Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You're just trying to destabilize my confidence as much as possible. It's a psychological warfare. I think it's beneath you, and I'm so disappointed to see it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh! All right, sorry, I'm taking so long. Okay.
Nah.
Okay, I'm trying to get a good sense of this episode. I'm trying to distill a nice, good hint for you.
Nice, mm-hmm. nice. I like that.
Yeah.
The hint distillery over here.
Mm-hmm.
Just got some really like finely crafted
micro
brew hints.
I've got a good one. Nice. This has got a good nose on it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't like that at all. I did not enjoy that. I don't like hearing about the scent of your hints.
Oh boy. All right. Here we go. This episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Ooh.
That's right. Takes its title from a quote attributed to the Roman poet Juvenal. The quote being, ooh. Oh, do you want me to just stop right there?
No, go ahead.
All right.
Go
ahead. The phrase being Latin. I don't want to butcher this. I don't want to butcher this phrase.
Oh, no, it's okay. Go ahead. Tell me the episode title in Latin. It's fine.
No, I'm not gonna.
I think I know what it is. Anyway.
All right. Do you know what it is?
Is it Who Watches the Watchers?
Good job.
Yes.
There you go.
One of the best episodes of speculative fiction ever, dude. Ray Wise is the main guest star in that episode.
He's a gift he is to
so
cinema.
Awesome. He is.
He's one of the best.
Blessing. Yes. Absolutely.
So glad that guy is around.
But yeah, that is early in season three, mm-hmm. which it's so funny, dude, with Next Generation, because season three is not only the season where the show finally got its shit together after two really uneven seasons, but it also has like most of the classic episodes of the show in it. It's like it got good and it was just amazing and never really hit that high again afterward.
How many seasons were there?
There were seven total.
Wow. Okay.
And like, I mean, 4, 5, and 6 are all really strong, mm-hmm. but like if you put together the like classic episodes that people love from those three seasons, mm-hmm. it probably wouldn't even be as many as are just in season three alone.
That's interesting because I think crazy. The last time that we were talking,
yeah,
you were having some doubts as to whether or not season one of The Sopranos is the best season.
Is the best.
And so I'm wondering, like, pound for pound, episode for episode.
Right.
Is it season one or is it season two?
Oh, I know, man. We're going to have to keep chewing over it. I think I'm going to start watching season two right now just to sort of, like, see how the quality holds up in comparison again, you know, and we might have to come back. We might have to do like, you know, a returning miniseries at some later date where we go back and say, you know, was that the season or is this the season? You know?
Man.
I'm down. I mean, if there's a show to double dip on, it's The Sopranos.
Oh, for sure. Know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would agree. But
no, I'm so glad we're starting here. It really is like the beginning of all things, you know, if Kate Blanchett was like portentously narrating the story of the golden age of television, like this would be the start. This would be where the ring was created. You know what I mean?
I see you just casually drop that LOTR reference right there.
Absolutely, man.
You just can't help yourself.
I really can't. I'm compelled to. Like Gollum with the ring. That's how I feel about Fellowship.
Oh my gosh, you fiend.
Yeah. All right. Well, to wrap things up, we so appreciate you listening. Please rate, review, and subscribe on whatever podcast application you are using.
Do it.
And we'll see you next week for college.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.